widely criticized as an ineffective and even superficial measure.
For many people, this bill is insufficient in comparison with the scope of the crisis. The same criticism has been made of a government fuel rebate of 18 cents, which began in April. However, it is 20 billion euros which will help the poorest level of society and students deal with the effects of high inflation.
France's government claims that upcoming austerity rollbacks planned for the pension and unemployment system will actually produce broad economic growth this time. The European Central Bank is raising interest rates, even though the eurozone is already on the brink of recession. Sanctions and not diplomacy continues to be the destabilizing Western choice regarding Ukraine. The long-term economic outlook for France and the eurozone appears bleak to many. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Thousands of Palestinians took part in funeral processions of Mohammed Azizi, 25, and Abdurrahman Subh, 28, who were killed early Sunday during an Israeli military raid in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus and its old town. The Fatah Armed Wing Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade says the two Palestinians were its members, while the Israeli military says the operation in Nablus was launched to apprehend armed suspects. Following the raid, a general strike called across Nablus to mourn the death of the two Palestinians.
The operation this time was more violent than the previous ones. Clashes were heavy as Israeli soldiers raided the neighborhood from all sides. Live ammunition and rockets were fired towards the houses. I believe such ammunition are only used in wars between countries.
Israeli forces raided Al-Yasamin neighborhood and surrounded a house, which the regime said Palestinian fighters had barricaded themselves in. Eyewitnesses described the raid as a full-blown military invasion, while the Palestinian Red Crescent reported 19 injuries, including 10 people, hit by live fire. The Palestinian leadership has condemned the operation, with a spokesman of the Palestinian president saying the Israeli crime will not defeat the Palestinians and will not break their will.
It's a barbaric act. It's another crime committed by the Israeli forces. They fired rockets at a house and they knew people were inside it. Two young men were killed and many others were wounded. It's obvious that the entire region will remain in a circle of violence until the occupation ends.
At least 52 Palestinians have been killed since late March, as Israel has intensified its aggression after a wave of deadly anti-Israel operations that led to the killing of Israeli soldiers. The Israeli military has never stopped its raids in the occupied West Bank. Such operations have often led to the death and injury of Palestinians, like what happened in Nablus. Regardless of how many people are killed or injured in the raids, Palestinians say resistance is their only option until they free the occupied territories. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight. The battle to become Britain's next Prime Minister descended into fierce clashes on Monday night, 25th of July, as Rishi Sunak launched repeated attacks on the economic policies of the favourite, Liz Truss, in their first head-to-head television debate. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnists Rajiv Sial, Ben Quinn and Jessica Elgott. The piece is titled Truss and Sunak Trade Blows in Acrimonious First TV Debate. The battle to become Britain's next Prime Minister descended into fierce clashes on Monday night, 25th of July, as Rishi Sunak launched repeated attacks on the economic policies of the favourite, Liz Truss, in their first head-to-head television debate. The two Conservative leadership hopefuls traded blows over tax cuts, over China and inflation, with a former Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, accusing the Foreign Secretary, Liz Truss, of seeking a short-term sugar rush by cutting national insurance. Liz Truss accused her former cabinet colleague of raising taxes to their highest level for 70 years. The exchanges at the BBC debate followed a weekend of deeply personal attacks, with Sunak criticised over his wealth and his wardrobe, as Liz Truss faced claims she was economically illiterate, while being reminded that she was formerly a Remainer. Rishi Sunak, widely seen as having to make up crucial ground to win over the Conservative membership, who will vote on 5th of August, repeatedly described his opponent's plans on the economy as not conservative, interrupting her at one point to say, "You promised almost £40 billion of unfounded tax cuts, £40 billion more borrowing. This is the country's credit card. It's our children and grandchildren. Everyone's here who are going to have to pick up the tab for that." Liz Truss hit back over Rishi Sunak's calls for a tougher stance on China, pointing out that the Treasury just last month was calling for closer bilateral and economic ties. Rishi Sunak accused his opponent of making pronouncements about a golden era between China and Britain. "I think that was almost a decade ago," the Foreign Secretary snapped back. Amid reports that Boris Johnson has not yet ruled out a political comeback, despite pledging to step down next month, both candidates also ruled out a role for the current Prime Minister in any government they might lead. "I'm sure he will have a role. I'm sure he will be vocal, but he will not be part of the government," said the Foreign Secretary, despite emphasising that she had been an early supporter of Boris Johnson's. She contrasted her continuing loyalty to him to those of others, adding that it would have been a dereliction of duty not to remain in her post. According to the Daily Telegraph, Boris Johnson told Lord Cruddas at Chequers over lunch on Friday that he wants to fight the next general election as leader of the Conservative Party, Lord Cruddas confirmed. Lord Cruddas is running a campaign to give Conservative Party members a vote on whether to accept Boris Johnson's resignation as Tory leader. But Downing Street responded by insisting that Johnson will leave the post when a new leader is chosen. On Boris Johnson, Liz Truss told the debate, "Having spent time with him this week on foreign affairs, I very much suspect that he would not want a future role in the government. He needs a well-earned break." Rishi Sunak, whose resignation from cabinet on the same day as Sajid Javid precipitated the ousting of Boris Johnson, paid tribute to Johnson as remarkable, but said he had reached a point where enough was enough. "I thought all the things that were going on the conduct side, were not right, and we clearly had different views on the economy side," he said. But with postal ballots set to arrive on Tory members' doorsteps by 5th of August, Rishi Sunak faced pressure to use the BBC debate and another hosted by Talk TV and The Sun on Tuesday to make an early breakthrough. Although he comfortably won the leadership race among Tory MPs, Liz Truss is the favourite to win after a series of opinion polls and surveys put her firmly ahead with party members. Perhaps as a result of this pressure on Rishi Sunak, the debate was particularly bad-tempered, with the former Chancellor often interrupting Liz Truss. At one point she said, "Under my plans, we would start paying back the debt in 3 years' time, so I'm not putting it on the never-never." The former Chancellor interrupted, saying, "That's simply not right," adding, "You promised almost £40 billion of unfunded tax cuts, that is the country's credit card." Liz Truss hit back, saying, "Rishi, that is not true. Under my plans, we would start paying down the debt in 3 years' time. COVID was a 1-in-100-years event. No other country is putting up taxes at this moment." The Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, has described Rishi Sunak's policies as contradictory. In the aftermath of the debate, supporters of Liz Truss argued that Sunak's interruptions were a result of his entitled background. "He came across like a public school mansplainer," said one. One Sunak supporter claimed that Liz Truss did not understand the economy. She was once again out of her depth, the MP said. Conservative Party grandees spoke out in the hours before the debate, pleading for both parties to resist from trashing the brand. But the tensions that have been building continue to manifest themselves, with Liz Truss declining to distance herself from comments by a supporter, the Culture Secretary Nadine Dorries, who outraged some fellow Tory MPs by comparing Rishi Sunak's Savile Row suit and Prada shoes to Liz Truss's £4.50 earrings from Claire's Accessories. "I'm not going to give Rishi fashion advice. I mean, I have said he's a very well-dressed man. I'm not going to give him fashion advice," said Liz Truss, when challenged about Nadine Dorries' comments. Lord Maud, the former party chair and minister for the Cabinet Office, had told the BBC's PM programme ahead of the debate, "One is obviously going to win the leadership, but if the behaviour of the teams and their language has been uncontrolled and it has damaged the party's standing or the way people see the party, then it could end up being a Pyrrhic victory." He said that the increasingly fractious tone of interventions from the campaign teams over the weekend had begun to appear like a race over who can sound more right-wing, as if that's the only game in town. Allies of Rishi Sunak said it was no secret that he had to make a significant impression in the debate, with opinion polls suggesting he's trailing his rival. But one campaign source said the polling from both YouGov and Conservative Home showed a wider gulf between the candidates than they had detected, and said many members were currently undecided. Liz Truss has strictly limited her broadcast appearances and has thus far declined to be interviewed by veteran political journalist Andrew Neil, who will go head-to-head with Rishi Sunak on Friday. Channel 4 said it was still hoping to convince Liz Truss to take part. Allies of Rishi Sunak have suggested he will take numerous broadcast opportunities in order to highlight one of his own strengths versus Liz Truss's perceived weakness. In previous multi-candidate debates, Liz Truss has polled badly with the general public, whereas Rishi Sunak came top in one debate and second in another. Earlier on Monday, 25th of July, Sunak teased his rival with a tweet, "Just me then," and a wink as Channel 4 announced the interview with Andrew Neil. Liz Truss's refusal echoed that of Boris Johnson, who refused to be interviewed by Andrew Neil during the 2019 general election campaign. Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss will take part in another head-to-head debate on Talk TV on Tuesday night and face off again at the first of members' hustings in Leeds on Thursday night.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Things are heating up again between the U.S. and China. Not that it ever cooled down, but this time China has issued a stern warning to the U.S. It involves the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's planned visit to Chinese Taipei, though not confirmed yet. China says it may have to react militarily. Why would China react to this visit to this degree? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the China-U.S. tensions. Any questions as to why the U.S. is carrying out provocations? We'll be addressing that from Ukraine to West Asia, and then to Asia itself. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Quindo Zhu, senior fellow at Pangol Institution, joins us from Beijing. We also have William Jones from the Executive Intelligence Review, joining us from Leesburg of VA.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both, gentlemen. William Jones, first over to you. Getting a mixed message in terms of the way the warning has come out. Just a couple days back, we had a warning that said that from China, that if this visit is going to take place, and this warning was supposedly done in private, that there may be a possible military response from China. Now it's not reflected so much in the news, aside from China saying that Washington would bear the consequences if this visit, which is not confirmed yet, were to take place. What's your reading into this?
Well, the warning still holds. It was made, it was done, and they're waiting really for a response. And the response will be either that the trip is somehow canceled or it takes place. And at that point, we will know what the response is, but there hasn't been any ambiguity on the part of the Chinese with regard to how they would react to this thing. This is a serious provocation. It undermines the three communiques. It seems to be, as China interprets it and as most people would see it, a step in the direction of moving away from the three communiques and supporting directly or indirectly China's Taiwan independence. And of course, that's a red line. And so if Pelosi does take this step, I think there will be a very strong reaction. What it will look like is still difficult to say, but I think China cannot not react to this, except that they would accept a greater provocation in the direction which they do not want to go.
Kim Do-ju, one of the responses that came from the Chinese Ministry of Defense, and it was reported in a private call with the U.S., signaled that there could be a military response. And along those statements, quote, if the U.S. insists on taking its own course, the Chinese military will never sit idly by. Do you think that if the trip takes place, many analysts say that's not going to happen, a military response from China. Do you think there will be one or not?
There will be one for sure. There's no doubt about that. It's really about what kind of a military action the Chinese side would take. The people are guessing that the likely choice would be, you know, escorting, you know, the plan of Nancy Pelosi and force it to change that direction. And the Chinese side will not allow the landing of Nancy Pelosi's plan in Taiwan. So in that sense, you know, basically forcing the United States to respect and what it has promised is a commitment to the One China principle. You know, in 1979, when China and the U.S. established the diplomatic ties, the foundation, one of the most important foundation, is that it severed the relationship with Taiwan, Republic of China at that time, and established the relationship with the People's Republic of China. It acknowledges, you know, Beijing is the sole legitimate representative of China, and Taiwan is part of China. And by sending Nancy Pelosi, an official with such a high seniority, that's a serious break, a violation of the One China principle. That I will undermine the political foundation of the relationship between Beijing and Washington. So China will have to move against that visit, you know, in whatever way. And one of the serious choice is really the military choice here. And there's basically no way for China to step back, even one inch, I would say. So, yes, China will respond forcefully and with the military airplanes.
Well, just to make sure that we understand this angle of it correctly here, I'm going to ask you this, William Jones. When you keep reading in the reports that they describe Pelosi as a Democrat who is second in line to the presidency, are they meaning that if there was to be, well, there is this notion of a military response, that therefore, because of her position, that would pose a national security risk? Is that why they keep mentioning Pelosi in that context?
Well, the reason that Pelosi is significant, not just a congressman going to Taiwan, the Speaker of the House is a part of the U.S. government. It isn't part of the executive branch, but it is an official part of the legislative branch. So that she would have to adhere to the policies of the government, which were accepted by the executive branch as well as the legislative branch. The One China policy is government policy. And so given that position, of course, this means that a high-level U.S. government official is breaking with that One China policy. In Pelosi's case, she's not the second but the third in line for the presidency, which also puts her in, you know, in a direct line with potentially executive functions, which makes it even more serious. So by doing this, and people are aware of this, and Pelosi is, of course, aware of this as well. And she and other people are intent on trying to push this Taiwan issue to try and, they think, contain China. But what it could effectively do is lead to a military conflict with China. And that's why you have seen the reaction from the Pentagon, which is certainly not pro-Chinese, but they have said, look, we don't like the fact that she would be doing this, because they realize that China is going to react, that they could suddenly find themselves in a military conflict with China simply because Pelosi decided to go on this trip. The White House has also reacted. Biden communicated the Pentagon's concerns to Pelosi. It's difficult to say, probably divided opinion within the White House itself, but I think there should be a certain amount of concern with regard to this as well. But they officially do not have the role of being able to tell Pelosi what to do because of the division of powers in the U.S. government. But if they were assertive enough, they could make it very clear that they didn't want her to go, and they could effectively stop this, I believe. Whether they would do that or not, I'm not sure.
Well, Kendo Zhu, before I turn to you, I had to take a glance over at the clock to find out how much time we have to look at the different ways that the U.S. disagrees with China on so many issues. I'm not too sure we could fill all of those in. But let's take a look at one of the most recent developments, unless you have one that comes off the top of your head. Go ahead.
No, it's really, I want to point out that, you know, you can ask the questions about this probably very likely upcoming visit to Taiwan. That is, we say provocative, and also you can ask the question, we say it's unnecessary provocation or unnecessary crisis in the making. You can ask for what is the purpose of Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan. Yes, we know that she supports Taiwan independence. Well, she wants to be there to show her support. Is that necessary? Because that will create a serious crisis that will undermine the regional peace and stability, that it could bring China and the U.S., you know, a military confrontation. Do we need another crisis around the world right now after we have this, you know, current climate change crisis, heat waves around the world, you know, Ukraine war, and food crisis, energy crisis, inflation, etc.? Is she that selfish? Is she simply for her political legacy, because midterm elections are coming, and she understands that the Democrats will lose the control of the Congress, the House of Representatives. She will no longer be the Speaker of the House, and the Republicans, one of them, will become the Speaker of the House. So, I mean, at the age of 1982, she retires very soon. So before her retirement, she wants to make some more controversial visit simply for her political legacy, at expense of China-U.S. relationship. I just don't understand, you know, why? How can anyone, any politician in that senior position, be that selfish?
Well, let's move on to some of these issues that exist between the two, which many have been emanated from the U.S. in many respects. And William Jones, one of them is interchangeable in terms of the way that the news came out almost back-to-back. It had to deal with the South China Sea, and then the military sales that happened to Japan and then Singapore at the same time. Now, these two pieces of news are interchangeable in the sense that I'm going to ask you, where you have China saying that on the South China Sea, that the U.S. is making statements regarding this area, but it's distorting the truth. And then it says South China Sea is the common home of regional countries, I'm quoting here, and maintaining peace and stability in the South China Sea is of utmost importance to not only ASEAN countries, but a common demand of China. My question is, are countries in that area actually on board with the U.S. in that aggressive approach towards China?
Well, not entirely. The basic problem is, of course, between the U.S. and China, let's put it mildly, is that the U.S. feels that it now must share, or at least discuss with China regarding world affairs, that it is no longer the decider of world politics. And it has been for many years. After the fall of the Soviet Union, the United States was number one, basically could determine what to do, and that's why they could start the wars in Iraq. They could, you know, do all kinds of stuff in the Middle East and get away with it. Now that's no longer the case. Both Russia and China are major powers, and if the United States had a rational attitude, they would realize that somehow we've got to come to agreement with them. But because they have different systems, so-called, they feel that this would be a loss of prestige. So much of this has to do with that fundamental question. Will the other countries come on board, the so-called allies? Well, you have the solid front, I think, of the Anglo-American crowd, including Australia and perhaps even New Zealand. The Japanese have succumbed to this to some extent, although they have a lot of economic ties with China, a lot of economic interest in China, and maybe they would only go so far. But we've seen over the last few days in the meeting between President Xi and President Widodo in Indonesia. We saw in Wang Yi's visit with the Philippines that these are countries who are around the South China Sea, who probably don't have the same outlook as China on that, but want to work together with China to resolve problems, because they feel that by working together, it's to their advantage as well, economically and in many other respects. So I think it's a more difficult call for the United States to pull together a so-called alliance of democracies in the East Asia vicinity, as sure. they have to some extent successfully done in Europe. Even that, though, is not going to hold over a long term either.
Well, Kendo Zhu, you have China coming out making a statement in solidarity with ASEAN countries that is going to further strengthen its cooperation, and at the same time, it will jointly resist all kinds of malicious acts of disruption, as China calls it, and destruction in the South China Sea. So when it comes to ASEAN countries, there's a united stance there, from what it appears, based on the Chinese point of view. China wouldn't come out and say that if it wasn't sure, I'm guessing, I'm asking you, if ASEAN countries were not on board. So isn't there this underlying unity with China, but in the face of the U.S., maybe not admitting to it as much?
Well, the South China Sea issue is interesting. It's complicated, you know, partly because it's a historical legacy. For example, you know, previously people would talk about the Chinese Nandesh land. That was a legacy of the Republic of China before the founding of the People's Republic of China in 1949. The Republic of China, actually the government, in a sense, is in Taiwan. If you look at the claim about South China Sea from Taiwan or from the Chinese mainland, it's the same, because it's inherited from that time, the previous government. Secondly, so China understands it's complicated. China has put forward this suggestion that is, let's leave aside the differences, because you know it's about a sovereignty issue. Sovereign claim, it's very difficult to solve that. You know, no country will give up their claim about their sea waters over there. So let's focus on the working together or the common interests. Let's jointly develop these resources over there. So in a sense, this is an issue between China, between Vietnam, you know, Indonesia, Malaysia, the Philippines, etc. Between these countries to find a way to solve this problem. So they are working on this code of conduct, COC, to basically discipline the behavior of every country so we can avoid any differences and focus on the development. But look, about Australia and the US and Japan, including India, they are not party to the claim of the South China Sea. Frankly speaking, you can say it's none of their business in a sense. But of course you would say, we have the freedom of navigation. You know, freedom of navigation is an idea basically serving the interests of big powers. You can say for the US probably, partially Russia, China, or India, because for smaller countries, just impossible to navigate a warship, for example, along the Atlantic to the close waters of the United States or European countries. How is that possible? It's fun, but that's also okay. The issue is like, the countries would ask all the countries in the region, China included, they are focused on development, investment, trade. So that's why you have RCEP, Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, focusing on the development, because that's a priority of every country in this region. But look, when the U.S. increased its presence here, it's not about economic presence. It's about a military presence. They send more aircraft carrier. They send more warships. They send more helicopters to challenge China, to challenge, including India, actually. So you can see which country is contributing to the peace and stability, because which is necessary for the development, which country is really creating trouble for the region and for the regional countries.
Well, you were speaking there, I took the time, which I think is very relevant here, William Jones, regarding the number of military bases that the U.S. has in this area in Asia. And I'm very surprised to find this out. I was not aware of this. We know there's roughly about 750 military bases that the U.S. has across the world. But what is surprising here, based on this particular stat, which I can see reflected in a number of sources that you have, from what it looks like over here, 80,000, up to 80,000 troops that operate from 120 military bases in the Asian territory. So that's about 10%. It's a lot. Does the U.S. then have, because our guests there talked about sovereignty, do the nations that host these U.S. troops not have sovereignty over themselves, especially when it comes to military operations, if directed by the U.S.?
Well, obviously, if the U.S. would deploy these troops in military action, they'd probably be able to do that. The countries could complain about it. But there are agreements that had been made for the stationing of U.S. forces in these areas. Now, what you have to understand, however, is that the United States, which traditionally was not a policeman of the world, after World War II began to follow in the steps of the British Empire. Remember, Franklin Roosevelt wanted to eliminate the British Empire. He didn't want any empire, but he died very quickly. And after that, the general attitude of the so-called policy planners in Washington was that we have to reinstitute the British Empire, because if we don't have them in those countries, we will be in a weak position with regard to the Soviet Union. So there was a push to really make the United States into something like a British Empire. So you see all these troops deployed, similar to what you had in the British Empire. They were deployed all over the world. And the countries have accepted that fact to some extent, but I think there are very grave concerns at the present moment, especially with the war in Ukraine, which is being promoted and pushed by the United States government, and the very provocative policy in the Asia-Pacific region, that if this goes much further, I think many of these countries that have been friendly to the U.S. and have accepted the fact that U.S. troops would be deployed there would maybe start to rethink that. Okay. Perhaps even Australia, which is an Anglo-American country, they're trying to have a better relationship with China. Maybe they would start rethinking the fact that they are allowing greater deployment of U.S. troops there, because it could be a danger to them.
All right, final question goes to you, Ken Dozhu. And the reason why I'm going to address this question to you is because you're in China. And I want to find out from you, what were your thoughts when a few weeks back at the G20, the U.S. Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, said China is the most serious long-term threat to the world order and universal values?
Well, that's an interesting comment. You know, when he refers to universal values, he means Western values, Christian values. Interestingly, basically his idea is like every country should accept that kind of values. I'm not sure every country, you know, in particular, like countries with a splendid history and civilization, like Iran, like China, like Russia, like Egypt, you know, those countries, somehow they have to accept the U.S. values. Isn't that laughable? And secondly, you know, to say China is a threat to this international order. Well, depends on what kind of order we are talking about. If it's about a UN-centered international order, and then China is the strongest supporter of the UN and all the international organizations. The thing is, the international order the U.S. refers to is really an international order that supports the U.S. hegemony, that supports empire, the U.S. empire in which U.S. dictates the global affairs, in which U.S. will enjoy this superiority.
Okay.
The U.S. enjoys the preeminence. With the rise of China, yes, that's a challenge to U.S. hegemony, unfortunately, you know,
okay,
to the
we'll
displeasure
have to leave it
of Washington.
Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. That's Ken Dozhu. Thank you, senior fellow at Pangol Institution from Beijing. William Jones, thank you for your contribution. Executive Intelligence Review from Leesburg, VA. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitavoy and the team, it's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
At the start of the COVID pandemic in March of 2020, the UK Health Department gave the first contract worth £133 million to healthcare firm Randox, without allowing any other firms to bid. The British government has suspended normal rules for awarding contracts as the pandemic was deemed to be an emergency. We have prepared for you an article written jointly by Rob Evans, David Pegg and Felicity Lawrence. The piece is titled, UK Health Department Played Fast and Loose When Awarding COVID Contracts to Randox. Please stay with us for more. The head of the UK Parliament's spending watchdog has said ministers and government officials played fast and loose when awarding £777 million in COVID contracts to a healthcare firm that employed the Conservative MP Owen Paterson as a lobbyist. In a damning report, the House of Commons Public Accounts Committee concluded that the government made a series of failures, making it impossible to know if the contracts had been awarded properly to Randox. The cross-party committee of MPs found that the Department of Health and Social Care did little to deal with potential conflicts of interest, despite clear concerns about Randox's political connections. It added that officials were aware that Paterson had been in direct contact with Matt Hancock, who was then the Health Secretary, while promoting Randox. The MPs found that Randox made substantial profits after it was given the contracts to carry out COVID testing during the pandemic. According to the House of Commons Public Accounts Committee, which questioned whether they were excessive, the firm's profits in the year to June 2021 were more than 100 times greater than the previous year. In its latest accounts, Randox reported a profit of £177 million for the year to 30th of June 2021. The MP said this compared with a profit of just £1.2 million that Randox reported for the 18 months up to 30th of June 2020. A Randox spokesperson accused the House of Commons Public Accounts Committee report of being deeply flawed and wrong in assumptions it makes and the conclusions that it draws, and added the firm had issued a legal complaint. He claimed at no stage, either during its deliberations or in its preparation of this report, did the House of Commons Public Accounts Committee make any contact whatsoever with Randox. Consequently, many elements of its report relating to Randox are false, based as they are on wrong and unchecked assumptions about the company. A spokesperson for the company has previously claimed that Randolph's contracts were awarded in full compliance with government procedures and protocols in place at a time of the emerging pandemic. House of Commons Public Accounts Committee also concluded that the Health Department did not keep proper records of why it gave the contracts to Randolph, nor of what happened when ministers met the company. The department was approached for comment. The publication of the report comes after Randolph and Patterson were accused of cronyism in parliamentary debates. Randolph paid Patterson, then MP for North Shropshire, £100,000 a year. The former cabinet minister was forced to resign from Parliament last November when he wrongly used his parliamentary position to lobby for his clients, including Randolph. Evidence of his lobbying had originally been uncovered by The Guardian. The Liberal Democrats won the subsequent by-election, and the lobbying saga, including attempts by Boris Johnson to force his MPs to change the rules to protect Patterson, contributed to fury within the party and among voters, which ultimately led to Prime Minister Boris Johnson's downfall recently. Between 2010 and 2018, Randolph donated £160,000 to the Conservative Party. During the pandemic, Patterson directly lobbied Hancock on behalf of Randolph. After Patterson's lobbying, Matt Hancock chased his officials, saying he was very worried about how his department was treating Randolph and other firms. The House of Commons Public Accounts Committee concluded that the department's woeful and poor record-keeping means that we cannot be sure that all these contracts were awarded properly. Even allowing for the exceptional circumstances at the start of the pandemic, basic civil service practices to document contract decision-making were not followed. It said that the Health Department neglected to scrutinise obvious conflicts of interest when it awarded the contracts, even though officials knew of Owen Patterson's contacts with Matt Hancock. Between January and October of 2020, Owen Patterson and Matt Hancock exchanged messages 8 times over private email or WhatsApp while the MP promoted Randolph. Matt Hancock has claimed he did nothing wrong. The MP said officials were also aware that Matt Hancock had received hospitality from Randolph in 2019 when he stayed overnight at a country estate owned by the head of the firm. Matt Hancock said he did not need to publicly declare this hospitality. The UK Health Department was also criticised for failing to meet the basic rule for publicly declare meetings between ministers and outside firms. Only 4 out of the 8 meetings between Randolph and health ministers were made public, as they should have been. Records of what was said at only 2 of these meetings were kept. At the start of the COVID pandemic in March of 2020, the Health Department gave the first contract worth £133 million to Randolph, without allowing any other firm to bid. The government had suspended normal rules for awarding contracts as the coronavirus pandemic was deemed to be an emergency. The House of Commons Public Accounts Committee said the award of this contract did not received the scrutiny we would expect from the department's senior civil servants. The role of the department's ministers in approving the contract was also confused and unclear. The MPs added, Randolph struggled to deliver the expected level of testing capacity against his first contract, which did not set out any performance measures. Yet the department still awarded Randox a contract extension worth £328 million 7 months later, again without any competition. Mick Hillier, the House of Commons Public Accounts Committee's chair, said, "We repeatedly hear the reference to the crisis we were facing as a nation, but acting fast doesn't mean acting fast and loose." She added that much of the business was won without any competing tenders from companies who may have had better capacity to deliver, pointing out that Randox had also been given money to pay for equipment to conduct the testing. A spokesperson for Matt Hancock said Randox was Britain's largest testing provider. Not to work with them during this unprecedented global pandemic would have been a dereliction of duty.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of